It can hardly be a coincidence that no language on earth has ever produced the expression as pretty as an airport. Airports are ugly. Some are very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort. This ugliness arises because airports are full of people who are tired, cross, and have just discovered that their luggage has landed in Murmansk. Murmansk Airport is the only known exception to this otherwise infallible rule. And architects have, on the whole, tried to reflect this in their designs. They have sought to highlight the tiredness and crossness motif with brutal shapes and nerve-jangling colours to make effortless the business of separating the traveller forever from his or her luggage or loved ones, to confuse the traveller with arrows that appear to point at the windows, distant tie racks, or the current position of Ursa Minor in the night sky, and, wherever possible, to expose the plumbing on the grounds that it is functional, and conceal the location of the departure gates, presumably on the grounds that they are not. Caught in the middle of a sea of hazy light and a sea of hazy noise, Kate Schechter stood and doubted. All the way out of London to Heathrow she had suffered from doubt. She was not a superstitious person, or even a religious person. She was simply someone who was not at all sure she should be flying to Norway. But she was finding it increasingly easy to believe that God, if there was a God, and if it was remotely possible that any God-like being who could order the disposition of particles at the creation of the universe would also be interested in directing the traffic on the M4, did not want her to fly to Norway either. All the trouble with the tickets, finding a next-door neighbour to look after the cat, then finding the cat so it could be looked after by the next-door neighbour, the sudden leak in the roof, the missing wallet, the weather, the unexpected death of the next-door neighbour, the pregnancy of the cat, it all had the semblance of an orchestrated campaign of obstruction, which had begun to assume godlike proportions. Even the taxi driver, when she had eventually found a taxi, had said, "Norway? What do you want to go there for?" And when she hadn't instantly said, "The Aurora Borealis, or Fjords," but had looked doubtful for a moment and bitten her lip, he had said, "I know, I bet it's some bloke dragging you out there. Tell you what, tell him to stuff it. Go to Tenerife." There was an idea. Tenerife. Or even, she dared to think for a fleeting second, home. She had stared dumbly out of the taxi window at the angry tangles of traffic, and thought that however cold and miserable the weather was here, that was nothing to what it would be like in Norway. Or indeed, at home. Home would be about as icebound as Norway right now. Icebound and punctuated with geysers of steam bursting out of the ground, catching in the frigid air, and dissipating between the glacial cliff faces of Sixth Avenue. A quick glance at the itinerary Kate had pursued in the course of her 30 years would reveal her without any doubt to be a New Yorker. Although she had lived in the city very little, most of her life had been spent at a constant distance from it. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Europe, and a period of distracted wandering around South America 5 years ago, following the loss of her newly married husband, Luke, in a New York taxi-hailing accident. She enjoyed the notion that New York was home, and that she missed it. But in fact, the only thing she really missed was pizza. And not just any old pizza, but the sort of pizza they brought to your door if you phoned them up and asked them to. That was the only real pizza. Pizza that you had to go out and sit at a table staring at red paper napkins for wasn't real pizza, however much extra pepperoni and anchovy they put on it. London was the place she liked living in most, apart, of course, from the pizza problem, which drove her crazy. Why would no one deliver pizza? Why did no one understand that it was fundamental to the whole nature of pizza that it arrived at your front door in a hot cardboard box, that you slithered it out of greaseproof paper and ate it in folded slices in front of the TV? What was the fundamental flaw in the stupid, stuck-up, sluggardly English that they couldn't grasp this simple principle? For some odd reason, it was the one frustration she could never learn simply to live with and accept. And about once a month or so, she would get very depressed, phone a pizza restaurant, order the biggest, most lavish pizza she could describe, pizza with an extra pizza on it, essentially, and then, sweetly, ask them to deliver it. To what? Deliver. Let me give you the address. I don't understand. Aren't you going to come and pick it up? No. Aren't you going to deliver? My address? We don't do that, miss. Don't do what? Deliver. You don't deliver? Am I hearing you correctly? The exchange would quickly degenerate into an ugly slanging match, which would leave her feeling drained and shaky, but much, much better the following morning. In all other respects, she was one of the most sweet-natured people you could hope to meet. But today was testing her to the limit. There had been terrible traffic jams on the motorway, and when the distant flash of blue lights made it clear that the cause was an accident somewhere ahead of them, Kate had become more tense and had stared fixedly out of the other window as eventually they had crawled past it. The taxi driver had been bad-tempered when at last he had dropped her off, because she didn't have the right money, and there was a lot of disgruntled hunting through tight trouser pockets before he was eventually able to find change for her. The atmosphere was heavy and thundery, and now, standing in the middle of the main check-in concourse at Terminal 2, Heathrow Airport, she could not find the check-in desk for her flight to Oslo. She stood very still for a moment, breathing calmly and deeply, and trying not to think of Jean-Philippe. Jean-Philippe was, as the taxi driver had correctly guessed, the reason why she was going to Norway, but was also the reason why she was convinced that Norway was not at all a good place for her to go. Thinking of him therefore made her head oscillate, and it seemed best not to think about him at all, but simply to go to Norway as if that was where she happened to be going anyway. She would then be terribly surprised to bump into him at whatever hotel it was he had written on the card that was tucked into the side pocket of her handbag. In fact, she would be surprised to find him there anyway. What she would be much more likely to find was a message from him saying that he had been unexpectedly called away to Guatemala, Seoul, or Tenerife, and that he would call her from there. Jean-Philippe was the most continually absent person she had ever met. In this, he was the culmination of a series. Since she had lost Luke to the great yellow Chevrolet, she had been oddly dependent on the rather vacant emotions that a succession of self-absorbed men had inspired in her. She tried to shut all this out of her mind, and even shut her eyes for a second. She wished that when she opened them again, there would be a sign in front of her saying, "This way for Norway," which she could simply follow without needing to think about it or anything else ever again. This, she reflected, in a continuation of her earlier train of thought, was presumably how religions got started, and must be the reason why so many sects hang around airports looking for converts. They know that people there are at their most vulnerable and perplexed, and ready to accept any kind of guidance. Kate opened her eyes again, and was, of course, disappointed. But then, a second or two later, there was a momentary parting in a long, surging wave of cross Germans in inexplicable yellow polo shirts, and through it she had a brief glimpse of the check-in desk for Oslo. Lugging her garment bag onto her shoulder, she made her way towards it. There was just one other person before her in the line at the desk, and he, it turned out, was having trouble, or perhaps making it. He was a large man, impressively large and well-built, even expertly built. But he was also definitely odd-looking in a way that Kate couldn't quite deal with. She couldn't even say what it was that was odd about him, only that she was immediately inclined not to include him on her list of things to think about at the moment. She remembered reading an article which had explained that the central processing unit of the human brain only had 7 memory registers, which meant that if you had 7 things in your mind at the same time, and then thought of something else, one of the other 7 would instantly drop out. In quick succession, she thought about whether or not she was likely to catch the plane, about whether it was just her imagination that the day was a particularly bloody one, about airline staff who smile charmingly and are breathtakingly rude, about duty-free shops which are able to charge much lower prices than ordinary shops, but mysteriously don't, about whether or not she felt a magazine article about airports coming on, which might help her pay for the trip, about whether her garment bag would hurt less on her other shoulder, and finally, in spite of all her intentions to the contrary, about Jean-Philippe, who was another set of at least 7 subtopics all to himself. The man standing arguing in front of her popped right out of her mind. It was only the announcement on the airport tannoy of the last call for her flight to Oslo which forced her attention back to the situation in front of her. The large man was making trouble about the fact that he hadn't been given a first-class seat reservation. It had just transpired that the reason for this was that he didn't in fact have a first-class ticket. Kate's spirits sank to the very bottom of her being and began to prowl around there, making a low growling noise. It now transpired that the man in front of her didn't actually have a ticket at all, and the argument then began to range freely and angrily over such topics as the physical appearance of the airline check-in girl, her qualities as a person, theories about her ancestors, speculations as to what surprises the future might have in store for her, and the airline for which she worked, and finally lit by chance on the happy subject of the man's credit card. He didn't have one. Further discussions ensued, and had to do with checks and why the airline did not accept them. Kate took a long, slow, murderous look at her watch. Excuse me, she said, interrupting the transactions. Is this going to take long? I have to catch the Oslo flight. I'm just dealing with this gentleman, said the girl. I'll be with you in just 1 second. Kate nodded and politely allowed just 1 second to go by. It's just that the flight's about to leave, she said then. I have one bag, I have my ticket, I have a reservation. It'll take about 30 seconds. I hate to interrupt, but I'd hate even more to miss my flight for the sake of 30 seconds. That's 30 actual seconds, not 30 just 1 seconds, which could keep us here all night. The check-in girl turned the full glare of her lip gloss onto Kate, but before she could speak, the large blonde man looked round, and the effect of his face was a little disconcerting. I, too, he said, in a slow, angry, Nordic voice, wish to fly to Oslo. Kate stared at him. He looked thoroughly out of place in an airport, or rather, the airport looked thoroughly out of place around him. Well, she said, the way we're stacked up at the moment, it looks like neither of us is going to make it. Can we just sort this one out? What's the hold-up? The check-in girl smiled her charming, dead smile and said, the airline does not accept checks as a matter of company policy. Well, I do, said Kate, slapping down her own credit card. Charge the gentleman's ticket to this, and I'll take a check from him. Okay, she added to the big man, who was looking at her with slow surprise. His eyes were large and blue, and conveyed the impression that they'd looked at a lot of glaciers in their time. They were extraordinarily arrogant, and also muddled. Okay, she repeated briskly. My name is Kate Schechter. That's 2 C's, 2 H's, 2 E's, and also a T, an R, and an S. Provided they're all there, the bank won't be fussy about the order they come in. They never seem to know themselves. The man very slowly inclined his head a little towards her in a rough bow of acknowledgement. He thanked her for her kindness, courtesy, and some Norwegian word that was lost on her, said that it was a long while since he had encountered anything of the kind, that she was a woman of spirit and some other Norwegian word, and that he was indebted to her. He also added as an afterthought that he had no checkbook. Right, said Kate, determined not to be deflected from her course. She fished in her handbag for a piece of paper, took a pen from the check-in counter, scribbled on the paper, and thrust it at him. That's my address, she said. Send me the money. Hock your fur coat if you have to. Just send it to me, okay? I'm taking a flyer on trusting you. The big man took the scrap of paper, read the few words on it with immense slowness, then folded it with elaborate care and put it into the pocket of his coat. Again he bowed to her very slightly. Kate suddenly realized that the check-in girl was silently waiting for her pen back to fill in the credit card form. She pushed it back at her in annoyance, handed over her own ticket, and imposed on herself an icy calm. The airport tannoy announced the departure of their flight. "May I see your passports, please?" said the girl unhurriedly. Kate handed hers over, but the big man didn't have one. "You what?" exclaimed Kate. The airline girl simply stopped moving at all and stared quietly at a random point on her desk, waiting for someone else to make a move. It wasn't her problem. The man repeated angrily that he didn't have a passport. He shouted it and banged his fist on the counter so hard that it was slightly dented by the force of the blow. Kate picked up her ticket, her passport, and her credit card, and hoisted her garment bag up on her shoulder. "This is where I get off," she said, and simply walked away. She felt that she had made every effort a human being could possibly be expected to make to catch her plane, but that it was not to be. She would send a message to Jean-Philippe saying that she could not be there, and it would probably sit in a slot next to his message to her, saying why he could not be there either. For once, they would be equally absent. For the time being, she would go and cool off. She set off in search first of a newspaper and then some coffee, and by dint of following the appropriate signs, was unable to locate either. She was then unable to find a working phone from which to send a message, and decided to give up on the airport altogether. Just get out, she told herself, find a taxi, and go back home. She threaded her way back across the check-in concourse, and had almost made it to the exit when she happened to glance back at the check-in desk that had defeated her, and was just in time to see it shoot up through the roof, engulfed in a ball of orange flame. As she lay beneath a pile of rubble, in pain, darkness, and choking dust, trying to find sensation in her limbs, she was at least relieved to be able to think that she hadn't merely been imagining that this was a bad day. So thinking, she passed out. The usual people tried to claim responsibility. First the IRA, then the PLO, and the Gas Board. Even British Nuclear Fuels rushed out a statement to the effect that the situation was completely under control, that it was a 1 in a 1,000,000 chance, that there was hardly any radioactive leakage at all, and that the site of the explosion would make a nice location for a day out with the kids and a picnic, before finally having to admit that it wasn't actually anything to do with them at all. No cause could be found for the explosion. It seemed to have happened spontaneously, and of its own free will. Explanations were advanced, but most of these were simply phrases which restated the problem in different words, along the same principles which had given the world metal fatigue. In fact, a very similar phrase was invented to account for the sudden transition of wood, metal, plastic, and concrete into an explosive condition, which was non-linear catastrophic structural exasperation. Or to put it another way, as a junior cabinet minister did on television the following night, in a phrase which was to haunt the rest of his career, the check-in desk had just got fundamentally fed up with being where it was. As in all such disastrous events, estimates of the casualties varied wildly. They started at 47 dead, 89 seriously injured, went up to 63 dead, 130 injured, and rose as high as 117 dead before the figures started to be revised downward once more. The final figures revealed that once all the people who could be accounted for had been accounted for, in fact no one had been killed at all. A small number of people were in hospital suffering from cuts and bruises and varying degrees of traumatized shock, but that, unless anyone had any information about anybody actually being missing, was that. This was yet another inexplicable aspect to the whole affair. The force of the explosion had been enough to reduce a large part of the front of Terminal 2 to rubble, and yet everyone inside the building had somehow either fallen very luckily, or been shielded from one piece of falling masonry by another, or had the shock of the explosion absorbed by their luggage. All in all, very little luggage had survived at all. There were questions asked in Parliament about this, but not very interesting ones. It was a couple of days before Kate Schechter became aware of any of these things, or indeed of anything at all in the outside world. She passed the time quietly in a world of her own, in which she was surrounded, as far as the eye could see, with old cabin trunks full of past memories, in which she rummaged with great curiosity and sometimes bewilderment. Or at least about a tenth of the cabin trunks were full of vivid and often painful or uncomfortable memories of her past life. The other nine-tenths were full of penguins, which surprised her. Insofar as she recognised at all that she was dreaming, she realised that she must be exploring her own subconscious mind. She had heard it said that human beings are supposed only to use about a tenth of their brains, and that no one was very clear what the other nine-tenths were for. But she had certainly never heard it suggested that they were used for storing penguins. Gradually the trunks, the memories, and the penguins began to grow indistinct, to become all white and swimmy, then to become like walls that were all white and swimmy, and finally to become walls that were merely white, or rather a yellowish-greenish kind of off-white, and to enclose her in a small room. The room was in semi-darkness. A bedside light was on, but turned down low, and the light from a street lamp found its way between the grey curtains and through sodium patterns on the opposite wall. She became dimly aware of the shadowed shape of her own body lying under the white turned-down sheet and the pale, neat blankets. She stared at it for a nervous while, checking that it looked all right before she tried tentatively to move any part of it. She tried her right hand, and that seemed to be fine. A little stiff and aching, but the fingers all responded, and all seemed to be of the right length and thickness, and to bend in the right places and in the right directions. She panicked briefly when she couldn't immediately locate her left hand, but then she found it lying across her stomach, and nagging at her in some odd way. It took her a second or two of concentration to put together a number of rather disturbing feelings, and realise that there was a needle bandaged into her arm. This shook her quite badly. From the needle there snaked a long, thin, transparent pipe that glistened yellowly in the light from the street lamp, and hung in a gentle curl from a thick plastic bag suspended from a tall metal stand. An array of horrors briefly assailed her in respect of this apparatus, but she peered dimly at the bag and saw the words, "Dextrosaline." She made herself calm down again, and lay quietly for a few moments before continuing her exploration. Her ribcage seemed undamaged, bruised and tender, but there was no sharper pain anywhere to suggest that anything was broken. Her hips and thighs ached and were stiff, but revealed no serious hurt. She flexed the muscles down her right leg, and then her left. She rather fancied that her left ankle was sprained. In other words, she told herself, she was perfectly all right. So what was she doing here, in what she could tell from the septic colour of the paint, was clearly a hospital. She sat up impatiently, and immediately rejoined the penguins for an entertaining few minutes. The next time she came round, she treated herself with a little more care, and lay quietly, feeling gently nauseous. She poked gingerly at her memory of what had happened. It was dark and blotchy, and came at her in sick, greasy waves like the North Sea. Lumpy things jumbled themselves out of it, and slowly arranged themselves into a heaving airport. The airport was sour and ached in her head, and in the middle of it, pulsing like a migraine, was the memory of a moment's whirling splurge of light. It became suddenly very clear to her that the check-in concourse of Terminal 2 at Heathrow Airport had been hit by a meteorite. Silhouetted in the flare was the fur-coated figure of a big man who must have caught the full force of it and been reduced instantly to a cloud of atoms that were free to go as they pleased. The thought caused a deep and horrid shudder to go through her. He had been infuriating and arrogant, but she had liked him in an odd way. There had been something oddly noble in his perverse bloody-mindedness. Or maybe, she realized, she liked to think that such perverse bloody-mindedness was noble, because it reminded her of herself trying to order pizza to be delivered in an alien, hostile, and non-pizza-delivering world. Nobleness was one word for making a fuss about the trivial inevitabilities of life, but there were others. She felt a sudden surge of fear and loneliness, but it quickly ebbed away, and left her feeling much more composed, relaxed, and wanting to go to the lavatory. According to her watch, it was shortly after 3 o'clock, and according to everything else, it was night time. She should probably call a nurse and let the world know she had come round. There was a window in the side wall of the room, through which she could see a dim corridor, in which stood a stretcher trolley and a tall black oxygen bottle, but which was otherwise empty. Things were very quiet out there. Peering around her in the small room, she saw a white-painted plywood cupboard, a couple of tubular steel and vinyl chairs lurking quietly in the shadows, and a white-painted plywood bedside cabinet which supported a small bowl with a single banana in it. On the other side of the bed stood her dripstand. Set into the wall on that side of the bed was a metal plate with a couple of black knobs and a set of old Bakelite headphones hanging from it, and wound around the tubular side pillar of the bedhead was a cable with a bell push attached to it, which she fingered and then decided not to push. She was fine. She could find her own way about. Slowly, a little woozily, she pushed herself up onto her elbows and slid her legs out from under the sheets and onto the floor, which was cold to her feet. She could tell almost immediately that she shouldn't be doing this, because every part of her feet was sending back streams of messages telling her exactly what every tiniest bit of the floor that they touched felt like, as if it was a strange and worrying thing, the like of which they had never encountered before. Nevertheless, she sat on the edge of the bed and made her feet accept the floor as something they were just going to have to get used to. The hospital had put her into a large, baggy, striped thing. It wasn't merely baggy, she decided on examining it more closely. It actually was a bag. A bag of loose blue and white striped cotton. It opened up the back and let in chilly night drafts. Perfunctory sleeves flopped halfway down her arms. She moved her arms around in the light, examining the skin, rubbing it and pinching it, especially around the bandage which held her drip needle in place. Normally her arms were lithe and the skin was firm and supple. Tonight, however, they looked like bits of chicken's. Briefly, she smoothed each forearm with her other hand, and then looked up again, purposefully. She reached out and gripped the dripstand, and, because it wobbled slightly less than she did, she was able to use it to pull herself slowly to her feet. She stood there, her tall, slim figure trembling, and after a few seconds she held the dripstand away at a bent arm's length, like a shepherd holding a crook. She had not made it to Norway, but she was at least standing up. The dripstand rolled on 4 small and independently perverse wheels, which behaved like 4 screaming children in the supermarket. But nevertheless, Kate was able to propel it to the door ahead of her. Walking increased her sense of wooziness, but also increased her resolve not to give in to it. She reached the door, opened it, and pushing the dripstand out ahead of her, looked out into the corridor. To her left, the corridor ended in a couple of swing doors with circular porthole windows, which seemed to lead into a larger area, an open ward, perhaps. To her right, a number of smaller doors opened off the corridor as it continued on for a short distance before turning a sharp corner. One of those doors would probably be the lavatory. The others? Well, she would find out as she looked for the lavatory. The first two were cupboards. The third was slightly bigger and had a chair in it, and therefore probably counted as a room, since most people don't like to sit in cupboards, even nurses, who have to do a lot of things that most people wouldn't like to. It also had a stack of styro beakers, a lot of semi-congealed coffee creamer, and an elderly coffee maker, all sitting on top of a small table together and seeping grimly over a copy of the Evening Standard. Kate picked up the dark, damp paper and tried to reconstruct some of her missing days from it. However, what with her own wobbly condition making it difficult to read, and the droopily stuck-together condition of the newspaper, she was able to glean little more than the fact that no one could really say for certain what had happened. It seemed that no one had been seriously hurt, but that an employee of one of the airlines was still unaccounted for. The incident had now been officially classified as an act of God. Nice one, God, thought Kate. She put down the remains of the paper and closed the door behind her. The next door she tried was another small side ward like her own. There was a bedside table and a single banana in the fruit bowl. The bed was clearly occupied. She pulled the door to quickly, but she did not pull it quickly enough. Unfortunately, something odd had caught her attention, but although she had noticed it, she could not immediately say what it was. She stood there with the door half closed, staring at the floor, knowing that she should not look again, and knowing that she would. Carefully, she eased the door back open again. The room was darkly shadowed and chilly. The chilliness did not give her a good feeling about the occupant of the bed. She listened. The silence didn't sound too good either. It wasn't the silence of healthy, deep sleep. It was the silence of nothing but a little distant traffic noise. She hesitated for a long while, silhouetted in the doorway, looking and listening. She wondered about the sheer bulk of the occupant of the bed, and how cold he was with just a thin blanket pulled over him. Next to the bed was a small, tubular-legged vinyl bucket chair, which was rather overwhelmed by the huge and heavy fur coat draped over it, and Kate thought that the coat should more properly be draped over the bed and its cold occupant. At last, walking as softly and cautiously as she could, she moved into the room and over to the bed. She stood looking down at the face of the big, Nordic man. Though cold and though his eyes were shut, his face was frowning slightly as if he was still rather worried about something. This struck Kate as being almost infinitely sad. In life the man had had the air of someone who was beset by huge, if somewhat puzzling, difficulties, and the appearance that he had almost immediately found things beyond this life that were a bother to him as well was miserable to contemplate. She was astonished that he appeared to be so unscathed. His skin was totally unmarked. It was rugged and healthy, or rather had been healthy until very recently. Closer inspection showed a network of fine lines, which suggested that he was older than the mid-thirties she had originally assumed. He could even have been a very fit and healthy man in his late forties. Standing against the wall, by the door, was something unexpected. It was a large Coca-Cola vending machine. It didn't look as if it had been installed there. It wasn't plugged in, and it had a small, neat sticker on it explaining that it was temporarily out of order. It looked as if it had simply been left there, inadvertently, by someone who was probably even now walking around wondering which room he had left it in. Its large red and white wavy panel stared glassily into the room and did not explain itself. The only thing the machine communicated to the outside world was that there was a slot into which coins of a variety of denominations might be inserted, and an aperture to which a variety of different cans would be delivered if the machine was working, which it was not. There was also an old sledgehammer leaning against it, which was, in its own way, odd. Faintness began to creep over Kate. The room began to develop a slight spin, and there was some restless rustling in the cabin trunks of her mind. Then she realized that the rustling wasn't simply her imagination. There was a distinct noise in the room, a heavy, beating, scratching noise, a muffled fluttering. The noise rose and fell like the wind, but in her dazed and woozy state, Kate could not at first tell where the noise was coming from. At last, her gaze fell on the curtains. She stared at them with the worried frown of a drunk trying to work out why the door is dancing. The sound was coming from the curtains. She walked uncertainly towards them and pulled them apart. A huge eagle with circles tattooed on its wings was clattering and beating against the window, staring in with great yellow eyes and pecking wildly at the glass. Kate staggered back, turned and tried to heave herself out of the room. At the end of the corridor, the porthole doors swung open, and two figures came through them. Hands rushed towards her as she became hopelessly entangled in the dripstand and began slowly to spin towards the floor. She was unconscious as they carefully laid her back in her bed. She was unconscious half an hour later, when a disturbingly short figure in a worryingly long white doctor's coat arrived, wheeled the big man away on a stretcher trolley, and then returned after a few minutes for the Coca-Cola machine. She woke a few hours later with the wintry sun seeping through the window. The day looked very quiet and ordinary, but Kate was still shaking. The same sun later broke in through the upper windows of a house in North London, and struck the peacefully sleeping figure of a man. The room in which he slept was large and bedraggled, and did not much benefit from the sudden intrusion of light. The sun crept slowly across the bedclothes, as if nervous of what it might find amongst them, slunk down the side of the bed, moved in a rather startled way across some objects it encountered on the floor, toyed nervously with a couple of motes of dust, lit briefly on a stuffed fruit bat hanging in the corner, and fled. This was about as big an appearance as the sun ever put in here, and it lasted for about an hour or so, during which time the sleeping figure scarcely stirred. At 11 o'clock the phone rang, and still the figure did not respond, any more than it had responded when the phone had rung at 6:25 in the morning, again at 6:40, again at 6:50, and again for 10 minutes continuously starting at 6:55, after which it had settled into a long and significant silence, disturbed only by the braying of police sirens in a nearby street at around 9 o'clock, the delivery of a large 18th century dual manual harpsichord at around 9:15, and the collection of same by bailiffs at a little after 10. This was a not uncommon sort of occurrence. The people concerned were accustomed to finding the key under the doormat, and the man in the bed was accustomed to sleeping through it. You would probably not say that he was sleeping the sleep of the just, unless you meant the just asleep, but it was certainly the sleep of someone who was not fooling about when he climbed into bed of a night and turned off the light. The room was not a room to elevate the soul. Louis XIV, to pick a name at random, would not have liked it, would have found it not sunny enough and insufficiently full of mirrors. He would have desired someone to pick up the socks, put the records away, and maybe burn the place down. Michelangelo would have been distressed by its proportions, which were neither lofty nor shaped by any noticeable inner harmony or symmetry, other than that all parts of the room were pretty much equally full of old coffee mugs, shoes, and brimming ashtrays, most of which were now sharing their tasks with each other. The walls were painted in almost precisely that shade of green which Raffaello Sanzio would have bitten off his right hand at the wrist rather than use, and Hercules, on seeing the room, would probably have returned half an hour later armed with a navigable river and a mop. It was, in short, a dump, and was likely to remain so for as long as it remained in the custody of Mr. Slad, or Dirk, Gently, nay, Celli. At last Gently stirred. The sheets and blankets were pulled up tightly round his head, but from somewhere halfway down the length of the bed, a hand slowly emerged from under the bedclothes, and its fingers felt their way in little tapping movements along the floor. Working from experience, they neatly circumvented a bowl of something very nasty that had been sitting there since Michaelmas, and eventually happened upon a half-empty pack of untipped Gauloises and a box of matches. The fingers shook a crumpled white tube free of the pack, seized it and the box of matches, and then started to poke away through the sheets tangled together at the top of the bed, like a magician prodding at a handkerchief from which he intends to release a flock of doves. The cigarette was at last inserted into the hole. The cigarette was lit. For a while the bed itself appeared to be smoking the cigarette in great heaving drags. It coughed long, loud, and shudderingly, and then began at last to breathe in a more measured rhythm. In this way Dirk Gently achieved consciousness. He lay there for a while, feeling a terrible sense of worry and guilt about something weighing on his shoulders. He wished he could forget about it, and promptly did. He levered himself out of bed, and a few minutes later padded downstairs. The mail on the doormat consisted of the usual things: a rude letter threatening to take away his American Express card, an invitation to apply for an American Express card, and a few bills of the more hysterical and unrealistic type. He couldn't understand why they kept sending them. The cost of the postage seemed merely to be good money thrown after bad. He shook his head in wonderment at the malevolent incompetence of the world, threw the mail away, entered the kitchen, and approached the fridge with caution. It stood in the corner. The kitchen was large and shrouded in a deep gloom that was not relieved, only turned yellow, by the action of switching on the light. Dirk squatted down in front of the fridge and carefully examined the edge of the door. He found what he was looking for. In fact, he found more than he was looking for. Near the bottom of the door, across the narrow gap which separated the door from the main body of the fridge, which held the strip of grey insulating rubber, lay a single human hair. It was stuck there with dried saliva. That he had expected. He had stuck it there himself 3 days earlier, and had checked it on several occasions since then. What he had not expected to find was a second hair. He frowned at it in alarm. A second hair? It was stuck across the gap in the same way as the first one, only this hair was near the top of the fridge door, and he had not put it there. He peered at it closely, and even went so far as to go and open the old shutters on the kitchen windows to let some extra light in upon the scene. The daylight shouldered its way in like a squad of policemen, and did a lot of what's-all-thising around the room, which, like the bedroom, would have presented anyone of an aesthetic disposition with difficulties. Like most of the rooms in Dirk's house, it was large, looming, and utterly dishevelled. It simply sneered at anyone's attempts to tidy it, sneered at them and brushed them aside like one of the small pile of dead and disheartened flies that lay beneath the window, on top of a pile of old pizza boxes. The light revealed the second hair for what it was. A grey hair, at root, dyed a vivid metallic orange. Dirk pursed his lips and thought very deeply. He didn't need to think hard in order to realize who the hair belonged to. There was only one person who regularly entered the kitchen, looking as if her head had been used for extracting metal oxides from industrial waste, but he did have seriously to consider the implications of the discovery that she had been plastering her hair across the door of his fridge. It meant that the silently waged conflict between himself and his cleaning lady had escalated to a new and more frightening level. It was now, Dirk reckoned, fully 3 months since this fridge door had been opened, and each of them was grimly determined not to be the one to open it first. The fridge no longer merely stood there in the corner of the kitchen. It actually lurked. Dirk could quite clearly remember the day on which the thing had started lurking. It was about a week ago, when Dirk had tried a simple subterfuge to trick Alina — the old bat's name was Alina, pronounced to rhyme with cleaner, which was an irony that Dirk now no longer relished — into opening the fridge door. The subterfuge had been deftly deflected, and had nearly rebounded horribly on Dirk. He had resorted to the strategy of going to the local mini-market to buy a few simple groceries. Nothing contentious: a little milk, some eggs, some bacon, a carton or two of chocolate custard, and a simple half-pound of butter. He had left them innocently on top of the fridge, as if to say, "Oh, when you have a moment, perhaps you could pop these inside." When he had returned that evening, his heart bounded to see that they were no longer on top of the fridge. They were gone. They had not merely been moved aside or put on a shelf, they were nowhere to be seen. She must finally have capitulated and put them away, in the fridge, and she would surely have cleaned it out once it was actually open. For the first and only time, his heart swelled with warmth and gratitude towards her, and he was about to fling open the door of the thing in relief and triumph, when an eighth sense — at the last count Dirk reckoned he had 11, warned him to be very, very careful, and to consider first where Alina might have put the cleared-out contents of the fridge. A nameless doubt gnawed at his mind as he moved noiselessly towards the garbage bin beneath the sink. Holding his breath, he opened the lid and looked. There, nestling in the folds of the fresh black bin liner, were his eggs, his bacon, his chocolate custard, and his simple half-pound of butter. Two milk bottles stood rinsed and neatly lined up by the sink, into which their contents had presumably been poured. She had thrown it away. Rather than open the fridge door, she had thrown his food away. He looked round slowly at the grimy, squat, white monolith, and that was the exact moment at which he realized, without a shadow of a doubt, that his fridge had now begun seriously to lurk. He made himself a stiff black coffee and sat slightly trembling. He had not even looked directly at the sink, but he knew that he must unconsciously have noticed the two clean milk bottles there, and some busy part of his mind had been alarmed by them. The next day he had explained all this away to himself. He was becoming needlessly paranoid. It had surely been an innocent or careless mistake on Alina's part. She had probably been brooding distractedly on her son's attack of bronchitis, peevishness, or homosexuality, or whatever it was that regularly prevented her from either turning up or from having any noticeable effect when she did. She was Italian, and probably had absent-mindedly mistaken his food for garbage. But the business with the hair changed all that. It had established beyond all possible doubt that she knew exactly what she was doing. She was under no circumstances going to open the fridge door until he had opened it first, and he was under no circumstances going to open the fridge until she had. Obviously, she had not noticed his hair. Otherwise, it would have been her most effective course simply to pull it off, thus tricking him into thinking she had opened the fridge. He should presumably now remove her hair in the hope of pulling that same trick on her. But even as he sat there, he knew that somehow that wouldn't work, and that they were locked into a tightening spiral of non-fridge opening that would lead them both to madness or perdition. He wondered if he could hire someone to come and open the fridge. No, he was not in a position to hire anybody to do anything. He was not even in a position to pay Alina for the last 3 weeks. The only reason he didn't ask her to leave was that sacking somebody inevitably involved paying them off, and this he was in no position to do. His secretary had finally left him on her own initiative and gone off to do something reprehensible in the travel business. Dirk had attempted to cast scorn on her, preferring monotony of pay over regularity of pay, she had calmly corrected him, over job satisfaction. She had nearly said, "Over what?" But at that moment she realized that if she said that, she would have to listen to his reply, which would be bound to infuriate her into arguing back. It occurred to her for the first time that the only way of escaping was just not to get drawn into these arguments. If she simply did not respond this time, then she was free to leave. She tried it. She felt a sudden freedom. She left. A week later, in much the same mood, she married an airline cabin steward called Smith. Dirk had kicked her desk over, and then had to pick it up himself later, when she didn't come back. The detective business was currently as brisk as the tomb. Nobody, it seemed, wished to have anything detected. Dirk had recently, to make ends meet, taken up doing palmistry and drag on Thursday evenings, but he wasn't comfortable with it. He could have withstood it. The hateful, abject humiliation of it all was something to which he had, in different ways, now become accustomed, and he was quite anonymous in his little tent in the back garden of the pub. He could have withstood it all if he hadn't been so horribly, excruciatingly good at it. It made him break out in a sweat of self-loathing. He tried by every means to cheat, to fake, to be deliberately and cynically bad, but whatever fakery he tried to introduce always failed, and he invariably ended up being right. His worst moment had come about as a result of the poor woman from Oxfordshire who had come in to see him one evening. Being in something of a waggish mood, he had suggested to her that she should keep an eye on her husband, who, judging by her marriage line, looked to be a bit of a flighty type. It transpired that her husband was in fact a fighter pilot, and that his plane had been lost in an exercise over the North Sea only a fortnight earlier. Dirk had been flustered by this, and had soothed meaninglessly at her. He was certain, he said, that her husband would be restored to her in the fullness of time, that all would be well, and that all manner of things would be well, and so on. The woman said that she thought this was not very likely, seeing as the world record for staying alive in the North Sea was rather less than an hour, and since no trace of her husband had been found in 2 weeks, it seemed fanciful to imagine that he was anything other than stone dead, and she was trying to get used to the idea, thank you very much. She said it rather tartly. Dirk had lost all control at this point, and started to babble. He said that it was very clear from reading her hands that the great sum of money she had coming to her would be no consolation to her for the loss of her dear, dear husband, but that at least it might comfort her to know that he had gone on to that great something or other in the sky, that he was floating on the fleeciest of white clouds, looking very handsome in his new set of wings, and that he was terribly sorry to be talking such appalling drivel, but she had caught him rather by surprise. Would she care for some tea, or some vodka, or some soup? The woman demurred. She said she had only wandered into the tent by accident. She had been looking for the lavatories. And what was that about the money? A complete gibberish, Dirk had explained. He was in great difficulties, what with having the falsetto to keep up. I was making it up as I went along, he said. Please allow me to tender my most profound apologies for intruding so clumsily on your private grief, and to escort you to, or rather direct you to, the, well, what I can only in the circumstances call the lavatory, which is out of the tent and on the left. Dirk had been cast down by this encounter, but was then utterly horrified a few days later, when he discovered that the very following morning the unfortunate woman had learnt that she had won £250,000 on the premium bonds. He spent several hours that night standing on the roof of his house, shaking his fist at the dark sky and shouting, "Stop it!" until a neighbour complained to the police that he couldn't sleep. The police had come round in a screaming squad car and woken up the rest of the neighbourhood as well. Today, this morning, Dirk sat in his kitchen and stared dejectedly at his fridge. The bloody-minded ebullience, which he usually relied on to carry him through the day, had been knocked out of him in its very opening moments by the business with the fridge. His will sat imprisoned in it, locked up by a single hair. What he needed, he thought, was a client. Please God, he thought, if there is a God, any God, bring me a client. Just a simple client. The simpler, the better. Credulous and rich. Someone like that chap yesterday. He tapped his fingers on the table. The problem was that the more credulous the client, the more Dirk fell foul at the end of his own better nature, which was constantly rearing up and embarrassing him at the most inopportune moments. Dirk frequently threatened to hurl his better nature to the ground and kneel on its windpipe. But it usually managed to get the better of him by dressing itself up as guilt and self-loathing, in which guise it could throw him right out of the ring. Credulous and rich. Just so that he could pay off some, perhaps even just one, of the more prominent and sensational bills. He lit a cigarette. Smoke curled upwards in the morning light and attached itself to the ceiling. Like that chap yesterday. He paused. The chap yesterday. The world held its breath. Quietly and gently there settled on him the knowledge that something, somewhere, was ghastly. Something was terribly wrong. There was a disaster hanging silently in the air around him, waiting for him to notice it. His knees tingled. What he needed, he had been thinking, was a client. He had been thinking that as a matter of habit. Was what he always thought at this time of the morning. What he had forgotten was that he had one. He stared wildly at his watch. Nearly 11:30. He shook his head to try and clear the silent ringing between his ears, then made a hysterical lunge for his hat and his great leather coat that hung behind the door. 15 seconds later, he left the house, 5 hours late, but moving fast. A minute or two later, Dirk paused to consider his best strategy. Rather than arrive 5 hours late and flustered, it would be better all round if he were to arrive 5 hours and a few extra minutes late, but triumphantly in command. "Pray God I am not too soon," would be a good opening line as he swept in, but it needed a good follow-through as well, and he wasn't sure what it should be. Perhaps it would save time if he went back to get his car, but then again it was only a short distance, and he had a tremendous propensity for getting lost when driving. This was largely because of his method of Zen navigation, which was simply to find any car that looked as if it knew where it was going, and follow it. The results were more often surprising than successful, but he felt it was worth it for the sake of the few occasions when it was both. Furthermore, he was not at all certain that his car was working. It was an elderly Jaguar, built at that very special time in the company's history, when they were making cars that had to stop for repairs more often than they needed to stop for petrol, and frequently needed to stop for months between outings. He was, however, certain, now that he came to think about it, that the car didn't have any petrol, and furthermore, he did not have any cash or valid plastic to enable him to fill it up. He abandoned that line of thought as wholly fruitless. He stopped to buy a newspaper while he thought things over. The clock in the newsagent said 11:35. Damn, damn, damn. He toyed with the idea of simply dropping the case, just walking away and forgetting about it. Having some lunch. The whole thing was fraught with difficulties in any event. Or rather, it was fraught with one particular difficulty, which was that of keeping a straight face. The whole thing was complete and utter nonsense. The client was clearly loopy, and Dirk would not have considered taking the case except for one very important thing. £300 a day plus expenses. The client had agreed to it just like that, and when Dirk had started his usual speech to the effect that his methods, involving as they did the fundamental interconnectedness of all things, often led to expenses that might appear to the untutored eye to be somewhat tangential to the matter in hand, the client had simply waved the matter aside as trifling. Dirk liked that in a client. The only thing the client had insisted upon, in the midst of this almost superhuman fit of reasonableness, was that Dirk had to be there, absolutely had to be there, ready, functioning, and alert, without fail, without even the mere smidgen of an inkling of failure, at 6:30 in the morning, absolute. Well, he was just going to have to see reason about that as well. 6:30 was clearly a preposterous time, and he, the client, obviously hadn't meant it seriously. A civilized 6:30 for 12 noon was almost certainly what he had in mind, and if he wanted to cut up rough about it, Dirk would have no option but to start handing out some serious statistics.